I think that, that looking at animals does actually challenge what sociology is about, because it has so much focused on human societies to the exclusion of everything else. Whereas now what's happening is that people are arguing that, that society is not exclusively human, and that animals are a constituent part of societies, and that that does actually challenge sociology. How you would approach the study of animals sociologically is a, is quite a contentious question, because a lot of other disciplines have been looking at animals before sociology has really taken up the challenge. And it's just sort of working out. I mean, there are a lot of different ways of approaching the study of animals, and some people would still say that it's not really appropriate for sociologists to be studying animals, and it should be left to the biologists.
Is that in part resting on a nature-culture distinction or a nature-social distinction?
Yes, I think it is, because I think the interest in... Maybe it's not just animals, I mean, it's the non-human, I think, is perhaps a better term here. And its challenge is to a more conventional definition of what counts as the social. I think that's where its challenge is, which is why sometimes sociologists get anxious about it, because it does challenge a more traditional definition of the social, which is about human interaction. And I think, as Nikki says, that partly of what a sociological response ought to recognise is that the social does consist of more than human interaction. I mean, a number of the chapters in the volume sort of look at the ways in which human non-human interaction is profoundly constitutive of the social world. So it's doubly troublesome, if you like, to both have a definition of the social which is only about human beings, and have a definition of the social which doesn't recognise the way that is itself constituted through a whole series of associations with the non-human.
So the approach that you take would be to extend the notion of the social to include the non-human, as opposed to, say, actor network theory, and which would advocate dissolving the social.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that, yeah. There are obviously different ways in which you can approach that challenge to an orthodox definition of the social. And one of them, I suppose, the more radical version with a small r, is to simply abolish the social altogether and say we don't need to talk about the social anymore. And along with that goes all of those ways of looking at the social that have come to characterise much of sociology, you know, subject, object, and nature, culture, society, and nature, and so on.
And the distinction between the human and the non-human itself.
And the non-human, yeah.
Yeah.
But another response is to try and defend a notion of the social which recognises the usefulness of holding on to aspects of those distinctions, but defining the distinctions differently, which I think is what we would try to do.
And what problems do you see with approaches which try and collapse this distinction between the human and the non-human, between humans and animals?
We've alluded to already, I think it has quite profound implications for the discipline of sociology. I mean, if there is no social, then the traditional object of sociology just disappears. And why would you need sociology? That's one. I mean, there is also the political concern as well, in that sociology has sometimes falsely been regarded as a critical discipline, and part of its critical force derives from its definition of the social and a recognition that there are ways in which the social can be redefined, usually in a more emancipatory or progressive way. And I think approaches which abolish the human, non-human distinction entirely find it hard to secure a critical purchase, as opposed to an empirical description of how the world is associated in such a way to produce a stable version of reality. I think that's the political concern.
One of the other things that really concerned us, and particularly if you look at what's, I mean, ANT is quite a popular approach in animal studies, which is interdisciplinary, and a lot of geographers have done quite a lot on this. And they, one of the things that troubled me going to listening to people's presentations and how they were theorising animals at all, was that the way they use agency, and that agency is attributed to everything. So agency is attributed to people, to animals, to objects, to stones, to books, to everything. And I found that very, very troubling, because it seemed to me, and I mean both of us find it troubling, that if you attribute agency to everything in that way, then it actually becomes meaningless. And one of the things that we argue is that you have to have a sociological, or I mean it's we would argue that it's much more useful to have a sociological definition of agency, which differentiates it from action, and that there are political implications of using actor network theory and attributing agency to every single actant, and actually theorising agency in a different way, which is what one of the things that we argue in the book.
I mean, would you say that animals have any capacity for agency?
Draws on classical sociology in a way, and more recently the work of Margaret Archer. But it relies on, of course, this is the tension, it relies on the notion of the social. Because in distinguishing between action and agency, we argue that, of course, things can act. Animals obviously act. But all things, let's use the ANT terminology for the moment, I mean, all things that act, all sentient things that act, I don't actually think non-sentient things act. They have effects which are a result of the properties they have. But that's not action, as far as I'm concerned. But sentient beings act. Animals act. They do things, and with the purpose of accomplishing something. But it seems to me that the distinctiveness of sociology as an intellectual tradition, as a sociological imagination, is precisely that it distinguishes between actions and the conditions under which those actions take place. And it sees the conditions of those actions as temporarily prior to the action itself. Now, once you do that, therefore, you need a notion of the social to describe those conditions, those contextual conditions within which action takes place. So for a sociological notion of agency, therefore, will always be collective. It's not something, it's not an attribute that things or human beings have.
Or animals.
They don't have agency. They have the capacity to act, and they always act within certain conditions. And when they act, it's their capacity to accomplish things that we would describe as their agency. So it's not reducible to them. But whenever you do act in conditions not of your own making, or even very often of your own choosing, those conditions, of course, shape what your actions are able to accomplish. They constrain and enable you in all sorts of complicated ways. But agency is never reducible to animals or things. It's always more than that. It's always, therefore, collective. But, of course, that to make that argument, you need a notion of the social to describe or account for the patterning of those conditions. And that's why I think there is a tension in the volume between those who go with a more actor network approach.
Or material semiotic approach.
Or more material semiotics, or it's called, sometimes the new empiricism, the new materialism. But it's essentially a flat, as from our point of view, I mean, this is essentially a flat presentist form of ontology, where all you can do is empirically trace what is being performed now. Whereas I think we would want to argue for the existence of temporally prior conditions, which, when people or things or animals try to act, has all sorts of consequences for the nature of that action.
So animals can act, say, in the natural order, but in the same way that human beings can do, but they lack that capacity to act in relation to a social
order. No, they can act in relation to a social order as well. They do. I mean, if you think about domesticated animals, animals that live in families, animals, I mean, of course they do, because they're part of the social order. So they act and have effect in the same way as human beings do.
But so they don't transform or reproduce.
No, well, I mean, I think one of the distinctions we try to introduce in our own discussion of agency is the one that comes from Archer's work, which is the distinction between primary and corporate agency. And in the primary agency sense, that is in the involuntaristic placement within an already existing set of conditional relations, animals clearly have primary agency, and it's a very urgent one for them, because a key feature of the conditions that, of primary agency that most animals find themselves in, or many, are of course those dominated by human power. You know, so you know, the mass slaughter of animals for human consumption is one of the things that being born an animal means for you. And that's a condition, if you like, of primary agency for many animals. The key question, of course, is that whether animals can attain corporate agency, which is an awareness of what it is that shapes the conditions of their own actions, and then be able to collectively transform those conditions. And I think our view would be that the possibilities for animals to do that is extremely limited.
Is there some possibility, though, in your view?
Of animals organising collectively to change the political power structure? No, I don't think so. No, not against humans. I mean, what goes on in within particular social groups of animals is a different question. But within human society, I mean, not human society, that's the wrong thing to say, within societies that are co-constituted by humans and animals, I think it would be, I don't think it's possible for animals to self-organise. But that's one of the responsibilities then that human animals have towards other animals.
It stems from that.
Yeah.
But in relation to social structures involving non-human animals?
Well, I mean, we say extremely limited. I mean, that's simply because, of course, you don't know how some animals may develop. I've no idea. But, I mean, as things stand at present, I mean, animals, non-human animals, would not be able to attain any viable or significant forms of corporate agency. I mean, after all, most human beings find it incredibly difficult.
Yes, I was just going to say
that. I mean, you've only
that.
Got to look at, you know, what's going on in the Middle East or, you know, all over the world. I mean, people find it enormously hard to develop genuinely transformative forms of corporate agency for all sorts of complicated sociological reasons. But of course, it does fundamentally rely on the ability to transcend one's own conditions to the extent that you're able to comprehend them and communicate that to others sharing the same condition. And I think without, you know, without a form of grammatical language, I don't see how that's ever going to be possible. So I think that would, I mean, that would be our view, I think.
And then just as a final question then, has the relationship between human animals and non-human animals changed over the course of modernity?
Oh, well, I mean, there are lots of arguments which, I mean, there are a lot of theorists who argue, not a lot of theorists, because there aren't a lot of theorists working in this area, but there is the argument that there has been a major shift from modernity to post-modernity, and that the relationship between human and other animals has changed as a consequence of that. And it's shifted from one of mastery and domination. I mean, I use mastery in a meaningful way. mastery, domination, and exploitation, and that it's shifted much more towards being appreciating other animals and developing close relationships with them and wanting to protect their habitat. But an awful lot of that sort of theorising is not based on empirical research into how people's relationships or even society's relationships how the human-other-animal relationship has shifted. So there's a lot of empirical work that needs to be done. I mean, there are claims that with increasing ontological insecurity and risk, there's been the development of misanthropy, and that people and the loosening of networks, really, the increased loneliness, that people are turning more towards animals and they don't for companionship and so on and so forth. But that's the area that really needs much more exploration, because other animals have always been important. And if you look at anthropological work, a lot of societies do keep animals as pets. I mean, it's not just postmodern society or even industrial society or the bourgeoisie or whatever it is that keep animals as pets. That goes on in a lot of different types of society, so that people develop those sorts of close relationships.
Is that very common then? Because I think a lot of people would assume that although they might recognise that humans have always had relationships with animals in that sense, that these might have previously been more to do with mutual gain. Like the one that obviously springs immediately to mind for me is, when cats had a practical purpose for catching mice and protecting food stocks.
Yes. Well, I think that's changed. I think that's changed. I mean, from some research that I've been doing, that there's certainly evidence that there's a shift, that for most people, the animals that are part of their lives are not, they don't have that same sort of functional role. Like they're not working animals. They don't round up the sheep or whatever it is.
When my cat catches mice, I see it as a bad thing.
You see it as a bad thing. A cat that catches a mouse.
Because she leaves dead animals on my floor, and it's not very welcome.
No, well, that is a big shift then. Mm. I mean, that's the sort of shift that has happened. But I don't think that means that people necessarily relate to animals differently, but the range of relationships that are possible with animals has changed. So I think individuals have always forged close relationships. I mean, you can't say always, can you? But individuals have, in the past, forged close relationships with particular animals, and that this happens now. But what you had much more of in the past was a whole other set of relationships with animals, because they were so important in terms of work and production, and people, when the people were much more using animals for food production and so on, and that was just part of the household, then clearly there's a different relationship.
Has the animal rights movement and the environmental movement played a big part in this? Or the causes beyond that?
I don't know. I think that's a really difficult question to answer, actually. I think this is really, really speculative stuff on my part, but I think there's what has happened, there's been a huge shift towards a real consumerist approach towards animals, and you have all these television programs about them now, which you never used to have, and people buy all sorts of things for their animals, and that has really been exploited. What did you ask?
Is this a change a matter of the animal rights movement and the environmental movement?
I think it's more to do with consumer capitalism, that this kind of affective, emotional bond has been really highlighted. And I don't think it's that it didn't exist before. I think it's that it's been highlighted and it's been exploited.
Because there's money to be made from it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, animals, all animals, human and non-human, have been commodified remorselessly. And, I mean, I don't see that non-human animals are going to be an exception to this.
Mm.
You know, it's just become another aspect of human need to have animals that say something about you. I mean, there's several pieces in the book which explore, for instance, the relationship between animals and national identity, the way certain animals then become invested with meaning as symbolic.
Like the British symbolic bulldog. Meaning of,
yes.
Sorry? Like the British
yes.
bulldog.
Yeah,
yes.
The British bulldog. I mean, there's Adrian Franklin's piece on the possum, isn't there?
Well, it's Purse Griffith on the
Purse
possum.
Griffith on the possum, yeah.
In New Zealand,
and the way this comes to be seen as, a sort of symbol of New Zealand character, whatever that is. I think those relationships have changed, but they've really been a consequence of larger social changes. I don't know, animal rights has certainly, and the environmental movement, I think have certainly had some influence on the way people have come to understand those things.
Well, yes, and they've developed that. They're associated with the whole critique of modernity, aren't they? And they're part of a sort of cultural shift in how we understand nature, in inverted commas, and the environment and the other living beings on the planet. So I think probably part of that cultural shift, which has been sort of pinpointed in the 60s, is re-evaluating how the human population relates to the other living beings on the planet.
Mm.
I think there has been that sort of a shift, and no doubt the environmental movement has been pretty important in contributing to that shift and being part of it.
Even though theoretically it often doesn't go beyond sort of modernist categories of thinking about nature and culture and society, and often reproduces these.
Protecting nature from society.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean that is one of the more interesting arguments of, you know, ANT, that it does want to query fundamentally those sorts of concepts. And how they can be managed or used politically in an effective way. Latour, for example, argues that the political ecology movement has to let go of nature.
Mm.
He says you can't have a viable ecological politics that has a notion of nature. These are quite interesting debates. It's a very interesting time for the whole issue of human, non-human animal relations, I think.
The field of study as a whole is expanding then, because it does sound like there are some fascinating questions to be addressed.
I think there are. And of course, although it appears a specific debate at one level, of course, it's really quite fundamental in the challenge it's posing to sociology, in its questioning of the whole notion of a social and what the social means. And whether we can redefine the social in ways that allow it to account for the non-human.
Because some people might consider it as a peripheral area of inquiry, but it's an empirical and theoretical one to all these very important questions.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I must admit, I was one of those who a few years ago did think it was peripheral. I couldn't see why it should be central. But certainly the work, Nicky and I have done over the last 2 years or so, has made me realise that actually it's far more central than I thought. And I think far more potentially far-reaching in its criticism of the social sciences than I certainly thought